Is that the get rid of everything that doesn't bring you joy thing?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. That one.
Does it spark joy when you hold it?
And if I don't really understand that, because I don't really find a lot of joy in my toothbrush, but I'm not going to get rid of that.
It depends what you're doing with your toothbrush.
Everyone, and welcome to another magnificent episode of Somewhere in Between, the AIT podcast brought to you by the Royal College of GPs. I'm Anthony, and I'm back with Hatim, Mira, and Johannes. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey.
So today we're back with part two of our digital health duo of episodes. And again, to start off this week's episode, we are having another conversation with a leader in the world of digital healthcare. And Hatim this week caught up with Dr. Manil Bakai, who is a GP and also the clinical lead for digital first primary care at NHS England. So let's listen to their conversation.
Hi, this is Hatim Abdul-Hussein, and today I'm with Dr. Manil Bakai. Dr. Bakai is Deputy Director at NHS England, working as a National Clinical Lead for Digital First Primary Care. Hi, Manil.
Hi, Hatim.
So today we wanted to talk about all things digital primary care, but first just wanted to understand your own journey, as this is quite a unique role that you're in. So if you want to just let us know about how you got into the role and what it actually involves.
Yeah, sure. So in terms of why I went into the role, I think digital health is something that I'm just simply quite passionate about. So after completing my GP training, I became a GP partner and have been so for the last 10 years or so. But alongside that, I've had roles in medical education, and I've also worked within the digital health sector. So I've previously worked in designing digital pathways. I've been a medical director in digital health and led the governance of an organisation, led the development of standards. And then more recently, I've worked in the research space. So directing research and evaluation of digital health pathways. And it's genuinely an area that I feel has huge potential. And I think that if we can get the approach right, it will fundamentally change general practice positively and more broadly primary care. But it is about getting it right and making sure that it's inclusive and it improves quality of care and continuity of care. And actually, that's less about the technology, but it's about being able to use it and that technology being usable and joined up and seamless for that real transformation to happen, particularly around how we can use digital to help us redesign pathways and care, how we can actually use it to reduce inequalities. So often there is this concern about the digital divide, but by providing more choice into the system, we can reach more people if we design the rest of our care processes and workflows to enable equality. How we can use digital to improve continuity, because definitely where we see it being implemented successfully, practices have seen a huge jump in the continuity of care that they provide their patients, up to 70 to 90%. So it has great potential with that regard, but also building in more choice for our patients and flexibility for clinicians, and thereby improving the experience for our workforce. And that's all really exciting. And interesting. And I'm keen that we can support and showcase just how well primary care innovates. And we move away from a one-size-fits-all model, because we know that that doesn't work for everyone. It's not inclusive, and start embedding positive change and help general practice to feel like they are and continue to be invested in. I guess in terms of, you know, my journey, it has definitely centered around relationships, building connections and investing in people. I found that that really helps build strong and resilient teams. I'm a firm believer in flattening the hierarchy. I value relationships far more than power, and I think that they are the key for real progress, particularly in this space. I found having a solid peer-to-peer network, remaining close to my work as a frontline GP, listening closely to the voices of my colleagues, so that I can help facilitate and support them in being able to lead and build a better future for primary care. And I think it's worth saying that in this crisis, you know, primary care has demonstrated the power of collaborative leadership. So I think long gone are the days of a single leader at the helm of a ship. Primary care, we've demonstrated that we can achieve so much more together than working alone or in silos. And PCNs have really come into their own, leading huge amounts of local change, being empowered to redesign, reorganise, and adapt to new ways of working in a very agile manner. And I think, you know, we need to continue on that road.
And sticking to thinking about how things have progressed during this pandemic, so it's difficult not to talk about or really anything else other than COVID-19 at the moment. What sort of impact has that had on the work that you've been doing at NHS England?
Yes, I mean, we have seen a tremendous amount of change in digital primary care in response to COVID. So practices have moved to a remote total triage way of working, enabled by online telephone and video consultations. And while this change was driven by the need to minimise exposure to COVID for patients and staff, we've definitely seen a growing confidence from clinicians and practice staff with this new way of working. Patients are also adapting to new ways of accessing general practice, and clinicians have been overwhelmingly positive about their experience of using online and video consultations. So there is certainly a view that this will now become a core part of the general practice offer, and should be used synergistically with face-to-face consultations to enhance traditional models of care. Pre-COVID, so to put it in context, pre-COVID, less than 5% of practices had a video consultation solution available, and less than 35% of practices had an online consultation solution available. And now we see online consultations are available in 85% of practices, covering 86% of the population, with a further 10% of practices about to go live very soon. And video consultations are available in 99% of practices, covering 99% of the population. Other changes have been a move to remote working, becoming part of business as usual. So rather than the expectation, rather than the exception, and greater investment has been made in IT infrastructure and equipment to enable that. We've also seen information governance assurance managed more centrally. So, for example, the COPI notice and improved data sharing between practices and PCNs, urgent care, 111, and the enhanced summary care record as well being made available to broader primary care to support safe and effective patient care during this crisis. I think it's important to stress, though, that there is still a lot of work to be done to support both the development of the products. For example, we need to drive interoperability and integration of products with clinical systems, which is an absolute key focus of ours nationally, and optimization of processes. So this is about service improvement, and it's not just about tech implementation. And with that mindset, we've nationally coordinated a support offer to all practices and PCNs to provide hands-on capacity, QI and tech expertise to help implement and increase utilisation of these digital tools to maximise benefit for patients and staff. And the service redesign is the real transformation here. And what we're seeing, where practices have moved to total digital triage, and that means whatever the front door, whichever front door the patient uses, whether it's an online consultation via the practice website, phoning up the practice and speaking to admin staff, or coming in person, although that's less likely at the moment during the crisis, they go through the same process. And so they complete an online questionnaire, either themselves by going online, or reception staff take them through that process together to capture their history. And then this information enters the same workflow and is prioritized by clinicians based on need. So it moves away from that first come, first serve type approach that we had in more traditional practice. And so everyone can have both the same experience and access, bringing about more equity. But there is also more choice in how patients access services. So many patients that are traditionally marginalised from general practice, either because they have a physical disability, a caring responsibility, a hearing or sensory impairment, or have previously experienced, stigma or negative feelings from coming into a practice, sitting in the waiting room, they often prefer to access services online. But equally, we know there are lots of patients that are non-digital users, and we must make sure that services are still equitable for them too. And so that they can still access services via the telephone or coming into the practice, obviously after appropriate COVID screening. And I think what the crisis has also really demonstrated is that digital inclusion is an absolute must, not just in terms of healthcare, but for more broader, general living and connecting with our loved ones. And so there is a real drive to improve digital inclusion, whether that's working through community partners, libraries and other community services to be able to access those people that we wouldn't traditionally don't traditionally come to general practice or primary care. And also building champions so that those champions, whether they be carers or other community members, can support others in using this digital technology and building up skills and confidence in doing so. And the Good Things Foundation have done some really great work in this space, and it's about building on their learning and others to support a broad population, inclusive population, in being able to use digital where possible. And I think, to inform how we build on the strengths and shape services going forwards, we are undertaking a deep dive evaluation with patients and practices to rapidly learn more about both the benefits and the unintended consequences of these new ways of working and accessing services, but also working on standardising the data that's collected from systems so that we can support practices, PCNs and commissioners to obtain robust and timely evidence about the impact of these technologies. So not just activity, but also outcomes, so we can support service and solution development in near real time.
It's really reassuring to hear the amount of work that's gone into particularly working on sort of reducing sort of inequalities and access to digital primary care and digital triage. On the other spectrum of it, there's a lot of clinicians that might have concerns about conducting a video consultation because they might not feel like they've been trained appropriately to do this. Particularly a lot of trainees will be doing this for the first time and will be unsure about how to undertake those consultations or also undertake the triage if they're using online systems. What sort of things have happened to help improve things for clinicians who are going to be working with these programs?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. This is new skills, a new way of consulting. I think what we've seen during the crisis is that GPs have been managing, in some cases over 90% of their workload remotely. And of course, I don't imagine that we as GPs will be doing quite so much remotely in a non-COVID time. But what we do know is that pre-COVID practices who had moved to this way of working, so a total digital triage way of working, were managing about 2/3 of their workload remotely. So perhaps as we hit recovery and reset, we may move to something similar to that figure. I think that we will embrace the benefits these different modalities bring, whether it be direct messaging, telephone, video and face-to-face, but use them synergistically so that they complement each other. And by moving to triage first, it enables practices to have more flexibility in being able to customize our appointment times so we can customize them based on patient needs, so we can spend longer with those that need it. And that will hopefully feel both more satisfying to clinicians and patients. I think remote working will remain an option, and this will help bring potentially more capacity back to the system as well. But training will need to include the skills in this new way of consulting, the use of digital tools, how we look at data and use data in our day-to-day practice to inform service improvement, and also remote consulting. So key things around that would be how to maintain the doctor-patient relationship, regardless of the modality through which we consult, navigating some of the complex scenarios that you could be faced with, but in a digital or remote environment. So ensuring that key principles of safe practice are embedded with this new way of working. I think there's also a role here in understanding the assurance around choosing digital systems, the clinical safety risk management and IG processes that need to sit behind these to make sure that they're used in a safe and effective manner. So we have written some guidance on how to do a total digital triage, so a blueprint on how to move to this way of working. We've written guidance on key principles for safe video consulting. And I've got two pieces about to be published shortly. So one on online consulting and what that consultation model looks like, because it is different to face-to-face. And we know from the evidence that online consulting, you can maintain the doctor-patient relationship through online consultations, but it helps where you already have a doctor-patient relationship already established. And also some guidance on intimate image sharing through a remote consultation, because this has been, a bit of a conundrum with combining regulatory, legal, professional issues to make sure that you can still provide care that meets the needs of your patients, that's in the best interests of your patients, but that also safeguards patients. And that's been a big cross-organisational piece with the regulators, with professional bodies, with legal teams and the MDOs as well. So hopefully that alignment will help provide the profession with a consistent voice, advice, message to avoid confusion going forwards.
Thanks, Minna. And where can we find those guidance and resources? What's the best place to look?
So the NHS England website, it will have all of these, but also we have a platform called the Future NHS platform, and I can give you the email address if you're interested in joining that after this podcast, and would encourage anybody who has an nhs.net email address, they can join, and it's a community of practice, so where GPs, other clinicians, practice staff can post, ask questions, raise challenges, and as a group we will try and facilitate and help provide a solution. There is a whole wealth of resources there, so we've the guidance that I've talked about, toolkits, blogs, all sorts of things to help people understand this way of working better and provide them with support. We've also developed some e-resources with HEE, so there are links to those on that website too. And I should mention, we're also producing a module with HEE around upskilling admin staff and care home staff as well in this way of working. So it's not just focusing on the clinician, it's focusing on primary care staff as a whole.
That's really important. Yeah, it's important to think about the practice staff as a whole, or primary care staff as a whole. And I guess that's a lot of the work that HE has been doing in terms of building a digital ready workforce and thinking about the wider multidisciplinary workforce. Moving forwards, what do you think is next? So what changes are we expecting to see within the next 12 to 24 months, potentially the next 5 years in general practice?
Yes. So as I said, there will definitely be a big piece around optimization. So we need to be able to optimise the technology to ensure it just does, it doesn't just meet the needs of practices during a period of crisis, but it develops for changing needs in recovery, reset and beyond. There have been some really great examples of suppliers really stepping up and co-designing solutions with practices, you know, really working very closely with them and their user groups to develop functionality that practices want and need. And so we're keen to maintain and grow that ethos. We need to ensure that we continue to maintain and adopt a service improvement approach to this, so that continual development. And so we will continue to provide practices and PCNs with support to iterate and adapt their processes and redesign pathways. I think that this is wider than general practice. So while we've focused on general practice, the aim is to integrate digital products into seamless pathways, but also with other primary care services and community services. So by having better data sharing and triaging patients to the right place of care from the and the right person first time, so we can reduce patients being bounced around the system. So there'll be lots of work around integration of tools and services. And that also provides an opportunity to build on the great work PCNs are doing and develop personalized models of care that are enabled by digital, enhancing population health locally and being able to use data for risk stratification and also focus on prevention and using shared skills within a PCN to drive that forwards. And I think data here is key. So we are producing a data set that is not just focused on activities and utilization, but also outputs and outcomes. And these metrics are based on the key priorities that practice, patients and commissioners have told us that they want to see. And we will try and auto-extract as much of this data to reduce burden on practices, but hopefully want this data to be used to contribute to more informed, value-based decision-making. And I think also just maintaining that alignment that we've seen across the wider system. So, you know, as I mentioned with the guidance, we've worked in partnership with lots of organisations at PACE. And from a primary care digital perspective, we've tried to provide a single source of the truth to avoid confusion, ensure consistency, clear messaging, and keen to maintain this with all the guidance and training that we produce, working with our partners. And I guess maybe just two other things that I think I would really be keen to maintain that are not specific to digital, but I think are absolutely core to progressing digital that we have seen in general practice during the crisis. And the first would be headspace. So during the pandemic, there has been a pause on assurance targets, some of the performance management type activities that practices have had, and therefore practices and PCNs have had the opportunity to think about innovation. And so while I think it's really important we have accountability and a level of assurance in the system, we need to be mindful of the proportionality and consider how we can maintain that headspace, because a lot of these models, particularly in digital, are emerging or will emerge if people have the chance to think about redesign, local need and innovation. And the second one is leadership, local leadership and collaborative working. And there have been some great examples of primary community and system working. And general practice has been a key voice at some of these decision-making tables. And we need to build on this definitely for digital. We're keen that commissioners and systems meaningfully engage with their PCNs, their practices, their LMCs, and their patients to decide how digital first primary care funding is spent to support the local ecosystem, to improve their digital offer to patients, and bridging some of that disconnect and empowering PCNs and patients to design how to embed change and support at scale delivery.
Those two final points are actually extremely key, and actually thinking about that local level driven change, digital transformation, is probably the best way to think about it. In terms of this podcast is mainly directed at trainees, though we have many listeners that are not trainees. What advice would you give the GP trainees who want to get involved with work either locally or nationally, or who are just interested in this space? what advice would you give to them?
Yes, I mean, I think digital is all around us. So, you know, just get stuck in. So it could be a practice level and helping your practice redesign their digital offer. So, you know, thinking about how to improve the utilization of online consultations, how that might work with total digital triage in your practice, how you design for inclusivity and continuity. So at a practice level, you know, we've talked about commissioners, PCNs and practices working closely. So get involved in a transformation role with your commissioner. So whether that's at a system or a CCG level, there are lots of opportunities there. We are nationally exploring, you know, whether we can bring in fellows into our team so that you get, you know, firsthand insight what it's like to be part of the digital first primary care team. But digital is everywhere, you know, it's at every single level of the system. So I think just get stuck in, find a project that's going to improve, you know, outcomes, that quality improvement approach, and get involved. And there is so much learning, and there are so many people willing and enthusiastic to help. You know, you've got your AHSNs, you've got your CSUs, your local teams, your regional teams, your national teams. Just reach out, and I'm sure people will bite your hand off to have your support and help.
Thanks. That's sound advice. Thank you so much for your time today. Is there anything that you wanted to just add in this conversation?
No, thank you very much for having me. And if people have questions, then feel free to email the Digital First Primary Care team. Her team, I can provide you the email address at the end of this podcast.
Yes, please do. And then we'll make sure it's in our description so people can contact directly.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Great. So, again, and I think another really interesting perspective on digital health, and I think always interesting to hear from kind of people working at the centre of things in policy at NHS England, just around their perspective. Hatim, what were your kind of big takeaways from the talk you had with Minal?
So my big takeaway was actually the focus on triage and the role that digital has played in the triaging system. So the way she described it, and actually even with my conversation with Dr. Gandhi last week, was that actually if we consider about how different digital platforms play different roles in that triaging process. So is that initial e-consult or initial form in which a patient fills out online to give you a bit of information about what's going on, or is that initial telephone consultation that you have with them, and then thinking about how you would use tech following on from that. So then, are you going to follow up with a video consult? Are you then going to think about maybe other measures that you can give the patient? So is that linking them into apps or podcasts or things like that that might help them if it's, say, mental health problems or even with other conditions like insomnia, etc. So it was just interesting to see how much emphasis has been placed on that during this pandemic, and that seems to be the main focus going forward. And then future considerations are things around sort of data and sort of information governance and all of those factors that actually play a wider role.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what I've really enjoyed about listening to the three different conversations is, yes, they were all so different. Everyone has found their way into digital tech in one way or another. And it was a range of, you know, the trainee voice and people who are working in primary care, seeing patients every single day, and then people who, you know, Minal, who does that, but also is working on in a much bigger scale and a bigger platform. And effectively, the thing that's united everybody to talk about this at the moment is obviously how COVID's been described as this huge disruptor, but actually has really united general practice specifically. And I think we heard this word quite a few times, is collaborative working. And that's that thing that has really been promoted over the last few months. And certainly I think we've all had independent experiences in primary care. I know Anthony and Johannes working in primary care where technology has really almost pushed through this ceiling that I haven't seen it since I've graduated from medical school. Would you agree, Johannes?
Yeah, completely. I think we talked about this previously as well, that there's such a diversity of approaches to this, because GP is such a kind of decentralized system and everyone works in very different ways. There's been a lot of experimentation with different technologies and different approaches. And I'm hoping that after this, there's a way for us all to kind of compare approaches and see what's worked and then really improve general practice, you know, across the board. I think the other thing that Hatta mentioned that's really interesting is just the amount of data that is going to be available after this is all over. And I hope, again, that that data is kind of used in a way that, that means that we can all benefit from it. Because Mira, as you said, this has been a really unprecedented experience for everyone, but it's a huge opportunity to learn very quickly and develop the way we practice.
And just hitting on that diversity point, I think Minal said it really, really well, is that we're making sure that we accept that it's not one size fits all. We appreciate that there are different kinds of tech that certain doctors and patients will take to differently, and other allied healthcare professionals, and really working out that whole skill set and range that we have available, that we, you know, we still want to see some patients face to face when we can, but optimizing all the technology that we have available to us, recognizing what may be suitable for varying populations that, that we serve. And I think, you know, before all of this, I may have been slightly biased in thinking that elderly people on the whole may not want to have used e-consulting and video cams and, you know, consultations like that. But actually, on reflection now, having done consultations for a number of weeks and months, people are really engaged with these things. Specifically, the population of the surgery that I work, the elderly grandparents have been given smartphones and iPads because that's a method of how they communicate with their families, and therefore they've downloaded the relevant apps for them, or they've been taught how to use websites, and people have time to sort of speak to each other about how to use these technologies. And that kind of communication is really new and exciting. So that's been a real shift in sort of what we've been seeing over the last few months.
The other thing that I found really interesting actually was, following up on what you said, Mira, is actually that is talking about inequalities, and everyone worried that tech is going to widen sort of inequalities and make access to healthcare even more difficult. But what I found really interesting through that conversation with Minal was that actually it's not always necessarily the case. And when she sort of brought up examples of patients that might have disabilities or other problems, that actually probably find it extremely difficult to come to a waiting room, sit in a waiting room, book an appointment that way through a receptionist face-to-face, and actually offering alternative solutions can actually improve their access to care. That actually was a really positive feeling to think about the role of technology for patients, most of all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, as has been kind of touched on in each of the three conversations, technology is really just an enabler. It's not really, it's like technology on its own doesn't really change anything, but actually it's the way that it enhances the care that we deliver. And it's all about, as Minal said, kind of service development and innovation, as opposed to the actual technology itself. The tech is just a tool to help you achieve a certain outcome, but still using technology effectively and implementing it is all down to kind of, you know, change management, quality improvement, which is hugely based on the relationships that you have with your colleagues, with patients, to get them to adopt new ways of working and get them to change, you know, the practices that we've all been used to over a long period of time. And I think, as has already been mentioned, that that has been the biggest change that's happened over the last few months, is to me a cultural change where people feel more enabled to do things differently, to innovate, to think differently. And patients have also recognized that the NHS can perhaps adapt a bit more quickly than they might have thought it would be able to as well. And, you know, again, I think people that I've been using video consultations with have all been amazed at how seamlessly it's worked, at least most of the time, how it does provide like a much greater level of flexibility and opportunity for them to access healthcare professionals and advice in a slightly different way. I guess from my perspective, I guess my only concern, or you know, an area that I do think is important to think about, is with the greater use of things like e-consult and digital kind of tech to help people improve their access. It is something that's open to everybody, but it still does favor a kind of younger audience at the minute, particularly I think things like e-consult. And definitely when I've been doing the e-consults, which is I normally have like a session a week just doing e-consults, I would say that 90-95% of them have all been from people under the age of 40, often with not trivial, but more minor concerns, which perhaps they would never have even approached their GP about in the first place and would have just waited for a period of time for it to get better on its own. So I think there does need to be a think around how, and obviously there's only a limited workforce in general practice. There's only so much that we can do. And so being able to target our resources to people who most need our care, I think, is important. So I think that thinking about how those tools can be used to kind of enable self-care and enable people to feel more empowered around caring for some of those minor concerns, which definitely eConsult and similar platforms have started to do and give you the option to do. But I think it's how we kind of make patients feel that that would be the right thing, rather than perhaps thinking that they might be better off speaking to a doctor just in case.
And I completely agree. I think we had all mentioned this certainly a few weeks ago, that when we weren't necessarily seeing as many patients or having much patient contact at all, when COVID was in its first surge and peak, we were reflecting that probably a lot of patients were sort of relying on self-care, using, you know, different tools and being more pragmatic about their approach, and maybe only contacting you when it was absolutely necessary. And it's about being sensible, isn't it? That the new technology is there to help patients have access to doctors and to other healthcare professionals, but also that there is no chance of that being overused or used in an incorrect fashion either. And I think, as Johannes says, through all of this, we will have vast amounts of data, and not just healthcare related specific data, but also informatics on, you know, epidemiology data sets, which kinds of people are more likely to be using those e-consults. And does that match up with how things were pre-coronavirus? One of the things that I really enjoyed from your chat, Hatim, with Dr. Gandhi, was he was talking about, it's not only enough for us to have that technology, but also it's really important that clinicians feel empowered to be able to use it properly. Because I think if you've never really been used to doing video consultations before, or telephone triage, which may have been the case in some places, if for the first or second trial it doesn't work, then you're much less likely to want to do it again. So there are so many resources out there, including Dr. Gandhi's videos on how to have an effective video consultation, you know, to maximize the chances of having an optimal outcome from when you try that. And certainly I've had instances where I've tried to have video consults and for one reason or another, it doesn't work. But with the patient, I just say, you know what, this is a new thing. Let's just try it again this way. And then if it doesn't work, I'll call you back and we can try something else. But it's not be disheartened early on as well, because it is quite new for all of us.
Yeah, I think on that, you know, the reason that things like video consulting has taken off so much in the last few weeks is because of platforms, and we mention them every week, free advertising, but Accurix. And, you know, the fact is that just the platform works really well and is really simple. And so I think that's been like the big disadvantage with health related tech over the last kind of decade, and is why, and you know, there's been loads of horror stories about trying to have a universal record, things that didn't go well, big data breaches, which have really undermined a lot of healthcare professionals' belief in the ability to deliver usable, user-friendly tech across the NHS. But I think that does now seem to be shifting, and again comes back to that cultural change and enabling more people to enter the marketplace.
Yeah, and often it's a crisis that sort of leads to innovation and maybe cutting of red tape that might have been there previously. I think one of the things I definitely want to talk about is Johannes's chat with Lydia as well, because obviously I think for me, talking about tech and innovation and all of this before the virus, you know, the pandemic happened, would be quite a scary thing in terms of how can, you know, trainees get involved? It seems so top heavy and everything comes from, you know, big departments and things like that. But I think Johannes's conversation with Lydia was really reflective, made me reflect on actually there are lots of opportunities out there. You just need to go out seeking them. I mean, what were your main take homes from that chat, Johannes, would you say?
I think the main thing that impressed me was just the general attitude that, like you said, you know, there are opportunities there, and it's partly about networking and finding out what they are. But if you look for them, you know, there's bound to be something there that interests you and will drive you forwards and help you achieve what you want to achieve. I was just impressed that she took that kind of brute force approach and just pushed until she found what she wanted, and then got involved in something that's been hugely influential for all of our day-to-day lives, and it will probably be a big part of our career going forwards, whether that's that specific platform or just that as a technology. But it's kind of made me want to sit down and think about, you know, what direction I want to start pushing in, because I think a lot of people choose GP because of the flexibility and the fact that it offers you routes into lots of other things. So I think it's really made me think about starting to look out for those opportunities and just see what is out there.
Yeah,
and I think one of the things Sorry, Anthony, go for it.
I think on that, just in terms of opportunities, and perhaps Hatem was going to touch on this as well, is that, you know, there definitely are so many opportunities you can get involved with as a trainee. So, you know, me and Hatem go way back because of a fellowship that we did last year, which was something called the National Medical Directors Clinical Fellow Scheme. And that was a, you know, they take trainees from across all different specialties. There were about six of us, I think, that were GP trainees, but 30, just over 30 in total. And you get placed in different arm's length bodies across the NHS to work on kind of specific policy in those organisations. So I worked at NHS Digital for the year, and I know Hatem worked at Health Education England, and was involved in something called Topol Fellowships as well, which was is a new programme that you might want to talk about.
Yeah, so sticking on a digital theme, so something that we set up at Health Education England was the Topol programme for digital health fellowships. And the idea behind this was to give clinicians, and this is clinicians from all backgrounds, so not just doctors, but give clinicians a couple of days a week. So they go, essentially, if you're a trainee, you go 60%, less than full-time, and it gives you at least 2 days a week to work on a digital transformation project, mostly at local level. So working within your trust or within your practice to really develop a new project or a new product that's going to drive patient care or improve patient care, along with maybe one or two projects that were actually nationally at arm's length bodies. A disappointing thing out of that is actually we didn't manage to appoint any GPs or GP trainees in our first cohort, but there definitely will be a second cohort. So it's just something to look out for, because there is an appetite for this in primary care. And as we've seen with over the last couple of months or so, the amount of new technologies, new innovation that's happening, there's definitely a need for people who are working day to day in that system, who understand that system, to be able to contribute. And actually, that's something I found really impressive about Lydia, is that she found that her own opportunity at Accurate and knew where she can contribute. And she was also very aware of at what point she could no longer contribute. So she was very clear that, you know, giving less than 2 days a week or whatever would not be adequate to actually, for her to be useful to Accurate, for example. And actually, this is the whole point of the Topol Fellowship, is to make sure that if we are giving clinicians time, it's enough time to actually achieve something, you know, reasonable from their project. And speaking to Minna earlier today, there's definitely an inclination there that at least in the digital affairs primary care team, that they would love to have trainees that can come and be fellows and work on projects. So I guess my key message is, if you have something that you're interested in, and Johannes, you mentioned this, you know, thinking about that direction that you want to go in, say it is digital, there's plenty out there already, but you can also form things yourselves if you look around. The other thing is the NHS Clinical Entrepreneur Fellowship. Many people who have ideas about making change or have their own sort of projects that they're already working on the side can get them recognised by the Clinical Entrepreneur Fellowship. And so you just got to have a look around and see what's available to you.
And I think jumping in on that as well is to recognise sometimes it doesn't have to be a huge idea at all. So it can be something very small. There are so many collaborative networks looking more locally within PCNs or groups of practices that may be getting together to try something new and working it on it in a bigger scale. And I think the other thing I would want to mention is, of course, there will be trainees out there for whom priorities are different right now. So whether or not that they are less than full-time trainees, or that their priorities getting through the training so they can be in a financially secure job. But that also means that there are opportunities available at any stage in your career as well. So if you still have an interest in something, it's important to try and keep in mind reading the magazines that come across. I say that as there's a stack of BMJs right next to me, but it's still in the plastic, but I will have a look at them at some point. But that these opportunities never really go away. It's just about the right timing for you and working that out. And I guess that's why PDPs are so important, because as we evolve as doctors and as people, obviously our priorities change, and adapting our career goals to that just seems really sensible to me, at least.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of GP training, especially. You can do it in any specialty, but I think general practice, everybody in the profession recognises that portfolio careers are what most people are interested in now, and that's not something that should have to necessarily wait until after your CCT. It's actually something that you can have the opportunity to pursue during your training. But equally, you know, everybody's training, their personal circumstances during training is slightly different. But for me, one of the the best things that I decided to do during GP training was to slow down a bit and to take a year out to do a fellowship, to go less than full time this year, to be able to do other bits on the side. And I think that that's the beauty of general practice training, is that that will never be something that people look down on. Actually having that skill, diverse skill set, and kind of exploring who you are and where you want your career to go is something that we have the opportunity to do.
Just on the magazines as well. So my Innovate magazines are still in their plastic as well. And apart from the times when my dad actually decides to read them, and he finds them fascinating. And I hardly ever look at them myself, but he's always reading them. He's just always telling me what's in them. So he's my main source of any Innovate knowledge in terms of the journey.
Yeah, my husband's exactly the same. The other day he came to me and said, do you know what sciatica really is? I was like, where is this from? It's all about the leg pain, not the back pain. I was like, oh, thank you very much. He's not a doctor. We put that out there.
Nor is my dad, but you know, if he reads enough Innovate, he might start consulting. Who knows?
Possibly. And I guess sort of rounding up our reflections and what we thought about listening to these three conversations, I guess it might be quite nice just going around, I sound like a teacher, but going around and sort of thinking of what our biggest take-home messages were from these conversations. I guess for me, it was really actually reflecting on how much we've come forward in a matter of months. And that's something I don't think I would have ever comprehended before. And really hoping that we stay on this momentum with trainees and people who are working in general practice and in secondary care, obviously, at some point, and just sort of keep riding on that train, I guess. So that would be it for me. How about you, Hatim?
So very quickly, Mira, I was going to say, you don't sound like a teacher, you sound like a program director.
I'll take that.
But in a little seriousness, my key takeaway is actually you can be very excited about all of these things, video consulting, using apps in your practice, but it actually doesn't make a difference until you actually do it yourself. So what I found is most recently in A&E, the one app that I got shown was Smart Optometry, so no need for a Snellen chart, you can do it on your phone. And the first time I used it, I wasn't really sure if I was using it properly. I wasn't 100% sure if the patient was understanding what I was trying to do. But actually, the more you start to use something, the more you practice at using some of the technology or the innovation that is available to you, the more comfortable you'll feel with it. And I think that's a message that goes out to all our sort of fellow colleagues out there, is to persevere a little bit and also just see how the patients find it and get their feedback on it too.
Cool. How about you, Johannes?
Yeah, so I think for me, I think we're starting to see slowly that things are going to return to something like normal as COVID kind of slows down, or at least the first wave, fingers crossed. And I think, as you were saying, Mira, we've had such a lot of change. We've had so much progress. And I think there's kind of a really big opportunity and maybe a responsibility to try and keep that pressure on. So, you know, as the waiting room starts to fill up again, or you know, as we start to get busy again with our day to day, we have to kind of keep in the back of our mind that, you know, we've made so much progress and there's so much more that we can achieve if we just carry on and go through the data that we've collected and keep experimenting with new technologies and comparing with other practices. So yeah, that was it for me.
And bringing it home, Ant, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that, you know, definitely the conversations we had over the last couple of weeks have really reinforced the fact that when change is done at a local level and people are given the autonomy to be able to make changes to the way they practice and use different tools, it actually can have the biggest impact and most beneficial impact. Having said that, obviously some things are best done kind of at a local level, but especially when it comes to digital tech, there are some big project things which definitely need a bit of focus on from the center. And I hope that the speed that we've been able to deliver stuff over recent months can continue there. I was just like, my dad's been suffering from diverticulitis the last week. He is now getting better. But I was talking to my mum on the phone last night and she was talking about some of his medications and she couldn't quite remember what was what. And she was like, can't you just look it up on your computer at the practice and just like have a look at his record? And I was like, if only, like definitely not. They're like, that's still just in many areas of the country, there's no way you'd be able to do that. Obviously you can get a snapshot of someone's medication from their summary care record. But in terms of actually having that kind of interoperability between systems, allowing the flow of patient data between different areas and different care sectors is just something that we still feels quite far away. And so it would be great if on those really big things we could start moving forward as well.
Yeah, I'm really excited for that day when we think about sort of patients being able to hold their own data, and especially the interoperability between primary and secondary care, and being able to share that information, and being able to see a patient and have all the relevant information at hand makes a big difference to the care you deliver to them.
Well, I think that's been a really interesting couple of weeks, just reflecting on what's current in the world of digital health from three very different perspectives in the world of general practice. I think as we come to the end of this week's episode, there's no way that we could record a podcast episode this week without referencing the events which are going on around the world in response to the death of George Floyd in the USA on the 25th of May, 2020. And obviously we're seeing protests happening all across the USA, the UK and the whole world as part of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think all of us, the four of us, were talking about this before we recorded today's episode. And this is a really difficult issue, which is incredibly personal to lots of different people. And everybody will have their own perspective and different ways which it will affect them throughout their lives and in the current day as well. But I think all of the four of us can say that we are all thinking about our Black friends, our Black colleagues, and what they're going through, and Black people all around the world who have been seriously affected by not just this episode, but a big serious systemic issue which does need addressing. I think as we move forward, I hope that, again, this kind of event will act as a catalyst for us to be able to think truly how do we handle some of the inequalities which underpin all societies, and how we can move on to a better place because of this. And hopefully similar episodes will never have to happen again in the future. So that's kind of where we're going to leave it this week. Wherever you are, wherever you're listening from, take care. Thank you for listening, and we'll speak to you again for the next episode of Somewhere in Between.
And then this one, are we going to call the other one about digital?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be the one about Bryn's toothbrush.
I mean, it could be.